You're in the program on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Sorrent Petro with you. Thank you for joining us. Second half of the program begins right now, brought to you by our friends at Worth Harley-Davidson North. Worth is at I-29 and Tiffany Springs. No payments for 120 days, 0%. Find out why Worth Harley-Davidson is the finest Harley-Davidson dealership in the Midwest for yourself. See them in person or find them online at WorthHarleyDavidson.com. They'll even deliver the bike of your dreams to your house. Go see them today. Worth Harley-Davidson North, I-29 in Tiffany Springs. If you are looking to GPS it, that is 9400 Northwest Prairie View Road. It is the best time right now. Zero down and make no payments until November, right? Zero down, no payments until November. And, of course, they'll even deliver that Harley of your dreams to you. So take advantage of it right now at Worth Harley-Davidson North. George Sharuri joins us here on the program, as he is wanting to do from time to time, from Pro Football Focus, data scientist. George, welcome to the Sprint Guest Line. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. You got me thinking about my childhood dreams of riding a Harley around. Those are long gone. I still have them every once in a while. They creep in there, and I have to throw them away because multiple people will not be happy if I have a motorcycle.
Maybe you need to get rid of those people. You know, I'm just saying, just something to think about.
There's maybe a trip in the future where, you know, there's a long open road, me and Harley Davidson. Saying. I don't know. Can you give me some advice, maybe? Do you own a motorcycle? Have you ever been on one of those trips?
I will tell you that, yeah, well, number one, I've got friends who absolutely, that is one of the things that they live for, is every year there's a group of them that they go out and they go on a ride, and it's absolutely like a must in their life. The advice I need to give you is just WorthHarleyDavidson.com, and you're all set.
Okay.
You're all set.
All right.
And you know what? Try them out. I haven't, I think this will probably not go well. One for you, and two, when Rick Worth and Chris Guerin and all the guys over at Worth hear this, see if they'll deliver to D.C. or Cincinnati, wherever you are right now. Ooh. I don't know. They say they're delivering, but see if they'll take it all the way out there. I'm thinking probably no, but I'm thinking there's probably a limit to how far they'll deliver, but test it.
I'm thinking it's a great excuse for me to get some Kansas City barbecue.
There you go.
And then I got to ride it back, you know, and that's an opportunity to break it in. It's like picking up a BMW in Germany and then driving it around Europe for a while. You know, you get to test out the merchandise right away.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. That's a good plan. All right. Listen, we've heard from the Chiefs coordinators here over the last couple of days, and I want to get your thoughts because this created a little stir. One of our buddies, Tommy Moe, good friend of the program, didn't like hearing Dave Tobe talk about the fact that Clyde Edwards-Helaire, he had all the ways he was going to use him on special teams, right? That should be music to the ears of Chiefs fans, because it means that the Chiefs are not doing what you and Eric Eager lament many, many times. Teams that either give a big contract or use a high draft pick on a running back, and now 32 is becoming really high for a running back. And as we know, Edwards-Helaire was the number one, or was the first back taken in this draft. But it doesn't sound like they're going to cater to making sure that number 32 looks like a great draft pick. They're still planning on running their team the right way. That should be music to the ears of Chiefs fans, correct?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, you know, there's two ways to look at it, right? You could be like, okay, well, I don't want to take a guy that's going to be a special teamer in the first round. But you also don't want to take someone who's going to pull your offense away from using the best weapon in the NFL as much as possible on offense, which is Patrick Mahomes. So I think it is a good sign. I also, you know, this is just from purely a culture standpoint. You never want to have a guy show up from the first round and not do the things that you'd expect out of any other rookie, right? And so I think that sets the right tone both off the field and mathematically, which, you know, helps you win games as well. So I would be happy about it. I want to see it first, you know, like I really do want to see them treat him just like any other running back, you know, before I believe it, but it's a step in the right direction for sure.
All right. I want to get your thoughts. I know you've been very big, and we've talked about it a couple of times, on The Last Dance. And, you know, we had the conversation, you know, first of all, how could the Bulls have tried to win a seventh? And I'm going to relate this back to football. How could the Bulls have had the opportunity to go for a seventh championship? And would they have won a seventh championship? All right, now I'm not going to bog down on the would they have won. That's a debate that is a basketball debate. But how they would have had, in other words, how could they have kept that team together? When you backtrack it, you know, because I know you spent a lot of time watching, and then I'm going to relate this to NFL owners. When you backtrack it, what mistakes were made by the organization, or what could they have done at some level that would have potentially, because everyone seemed to agree, no, it was over, that was it, was the end of the run. What needed to be done along the way to have given them the opportunity to play for a seventh?
You know, this is a really interesting question, and I remember that following season well, right, because it was, you know, a lockout season. I want to say they played, was it like 60 games or something like that? 50 games.
Yep.
And it was a condensed season. They had, you know, it was weird the way that it wasn't like there was this kind of clean break. It was sort of like, well, we're hoping to get these labor negotiations done. And then what happens? And then, oh, all of a sudden, like, Jordan, are you coming back? No. Right, because there are a bunch of things that happened with Pippen and Rodman and obviously Phil Jackson. But Jordan was the piece, right? Michael Jordan was the guy that was still in his prime. And I'm never going to bet against Michael Jordan, because I think what we saw in those finals was he by himself could literally beat anybody. But you've got to be ready to retool. And I think if you had Jackson and Jordan in place, you could have easily done that. Without them, it's obviously a moot point. I would not, you know, the San Antonio Spurs ended up beating the New York Knicks, and I want to say the Knicks were like an 8 seed, right, to make it into the championship. You're telling me the Bulls wouldn't have beaten the San Antonio Spurs with a young Tim Duncan? I have a hard time believing that. So I would have given them the seventh. I think it would have been very hard. But look, people counted them out against the Pacers. You know, there were a lot of people thought the Pacers were going to beat them in that seventh game. There were a lot of people that thought the Jazz had them. So it would have been, I think, same old story for MJ.
I think, all right, so for me, I think the thing that they would have needed to do was Jerry Reinsdorf needed to be a better owner, right?
Yeah,
when Jerry Krause started popping off, Jerry Reinsdorf needed to fire him. And he was, you know, I'm all for owners not messing with things. You know, don't mess with your GM. Don't mess with your coach. Hire the right guys. Let them do their thing. But when one of them's not doing the right thing, you have to fire him. And so, to me, the guy who kind of got off on this deal was Reinsdorf, who just sits there and is like, you know, I called Phil and, you know, I offered him. So, like, I did my part. I did everything I could. No, you should have fired Jerry Krause. Good man, bad man. I know he's dead and didn't get a chance to defend himself and all that. But the reality is, when a general manager is doing, you know, when you've got a star player and the general manager and the star player says, I'm totally devoted to the coach, then the general manager can't get sideways with the coach. And so, to me, what kept the Bulls from fighting for a seventh was Jerry Reinsdorf.
What's so fascinating there is, you know, obviously the first name is the same, but there's a similarity between the two of those guys that stuck out to me, which, and I, you know, obviously, rest in peace, Jerry Krause is not a part of the broadcast as he's no longer with us. But I would have been very interested to hear them both speak, because to me, Jerry Reinsdorf and Jerry Krause were probably in lockstep in thinking, I am a bigger part of this team's success than people are giving me credit for. And that type of hubris is ridiculous. I mean, just watch the games, right? But that Jerry Reinsdorf cannot get out of his own way, in large part because I think he wanted some credit for this and believed that he and Jerry Krause could put this thing back together, which obviously they could not. I wonder if firing Jerry Krause would have been enough to get Phil Jackson back. He seemed like he was, you know, he was – this is the natural conclusion, right? We burned our poems in the coffee pot, and now I'm moving on to the next thing. And I wonder if that would have been enough to get him to come back from the dead.
Don't you think the moral of the story is, like, it wasn't the last year that Krause needed to be fired. It's whenever it started showing signs of being a problem that Krause needed to be out.
Right.
I think so many GMs have learned from Jerry Krause's mistake that they understand defer to the players. Don't make yourself – like GMs now, like some of the – like Carl Peterson always liked to put himself out front as the Chiefs general manager. And he did a radio show and – and you know, for a while he was the toast of the town when he took the Chiefs from being a perennial turd to being a perennial playoff team. He was loved. He got Joe Montana and Marcus Allen. They got to the AFC Championship game, and somewhere along about like losing in '97 in the divisional round of the playoffs to the Colts, it all turned on him, and he couldn't go back behind the scenes. He was still out front. The role of the GM today. And I think Brett Veach does a really good job of this. I think he's learned these lessons, or Andy, you know, wherever it was, Andy Reid probably taught him, is to stay behind the scenes and defer to others, right? You don't need to be the guy out front. You need to be the guy, you know, pulling the strings behind the curtain.
I mean, this isn't rocket science, right? Like, you're not the one on the field playing. This isn't some, like, I can't believe the GM isn't taking credit for what these other guys who are actually playing football are doing. I mean, that is one of the hardest things to do in life. And sports is a really nice microcosm of a lot of the things that we face in our daily lives, right? And I think about this a lot in my role at PFF, right? People think we just sit here and think about football all the time. No, like, there are a lot of business processes that we have, and your ability to say, look, it's not about me, it's about the team, is very hard in a lot of different ways. And in sports, it's magnified because of how wealthy the players can become, I think, right? And that is something that is hard to do, to say, look, I'm not the most important person here. I'm not. And it's the players on the field that win us the games, and I've got to do everything I can to support them. And you'll still have a pretty nice life. Like, it's not like you got to go to the, you know, you got to go cut your salary in half or do anything crazy. You're still going to be in a pretty good situation, but it's tough for people to do. It really is.
You wish your star player was a sweetheart of a guy, right? But I'm always reminded,
right, what
one of the greatest lessons I was ever taught in covering sports, about sports in general, and I think this is true in life as well, is a lesson that was taught to me by Buddy Bell and Ranelvis Hernandez. Buddy Bell, 2000 hit club as a third baseman, many gold gloves and all-stars, managed the Royals when they were just terrible. Ranelvis Hernandez, I'm sure you don't remember, was an oversized but talented starting pitcher that basically ate his way out of the league. And he was kind of, he was immature. And at some point, Buddy Bell got frustrated with him, and they got into a brawl in the clubhouse. And from people I know who were there and witnessed it, the two were separated. Buddy Bell was pulled off. And Buddy Bell, by the way, at age 50-something, was getting the better of Ranelvis Hernandez. And he was pulled off, and Hernandez was pulled back. And Buddy Bell screamed at him, Ranelvis, you're not good enough to be an a-hole. And that's one of the great lessons I've ever learned, right? You got to be really, and that's true. Like, if you're a sales guy and you're the fourth best sales rep on the squad, you're not good enough to be an a-hole. If you're the number one sales rep, but you're only 0.5% better than number two, 2% better than number three, and 3% better than number four, you're not good enough to be an a-hole. If you're the sales guy and you sell three times as much as the second best guy, you can be an a-hole. They're going to tolerate it. Jordan could be an a-hole, right? He was that good. And my question is, like, I as I watch this documentary, you know, Krause is Veach just in job position, right? Reinsdorf is Hunt, you know, Phil Jackson is Andy Reid, and the Michael Jordan is Patrick Mahomes. How much do you think, and I know there's no numbers for this, so this is the art and gets you away from the science, how much does the likability, we want to follow this guy, matter for a guy like Patrick Mahomes or a guy like Michael Jordan?
It's such a good question, because it's the proof is what was the result? Like, did I win? And if you get a taste of winning, and I think that was one of the things that came through in the documentary for me when Jordan kind of broke down and he was like, I didn't want to just win this for me. Like, I wanted them to get the joy of winning too, right? And I think once you've had that success, you can come back to the well and you can say, look, I took you there, right?
Right.
And Mahomes is in that unique situation where, like, he did at a young age. And so I think he can be that way. And it has to be from the position of, look, I'm asking myself to do this too. And that's where people can sense, you know, if you're being disingenuous pretty quickly. And I think there are guys that tried to copy Jordan, and there are probably going to be guys that will try to copy, you know, some of these great quarterbacks. You know, Tom Brady comes to mind as a guy that's super demanding. Bill Belichick's super demanding. But if you're not demanding that of yourself, then you're not going to get away with it. And that's ultimately what leads to success, right? Like, if you're going to be that great because you demand that of yourself, then other guys will get on board and they'll put up with it because they want to win and they've tasted what it is to win a championship and they want to get back to it. But if you're not going to ask that of yourself, then you're going to fall short and people are going to be like, you know what? I'm done with this. I could fall short somewhere else where life is a little bit easier. But the Mahomes Jordan comparison is super interesting. I mean, he's obviously a little young in the process, and his mentality seems to be a lot more fun loving, which I think is a product of like the time we live in. And I wonder if it makes it impossible to have a character like Jordan that is as complex and interesting, because we've moved past that, maybe that time in sports where that's socially acceptable.
Does the position of quarterback just lend itself to where no one can slight you? You're the unquestioned leader. Everybody knows you're not only the most valuable person in your sport, you know, by percentages, you're the most valuable person in any sport. Nobody makes a bigger difference on any sport. The closest would be a Jordan in basketball. One guy out of five can, you know, is 20% of the team. But, you know, if your quarterback sucks, it sucks. Okay, if your quarterback's good, you can win even with mediocrity around you. Does that just lend itself to where quarterbacks don't have to go to the degree that Jordan did because they're so unquestioned?
That's a good point, you know, and I wonder if it forces it upon the quarterback a little bit. And that's why we see guys like, you know, 2 to 3 years, and you have it or you don't, right? And teams are passionate about it, and they argue about whether Mitch Trubisky is the second coming or not, and then they're let down, and it happens super quickly, and you either succeed or you don't. I'm going to kind of flip this one and ask you, do you think that the difference in how a quarterback only plays offense and is working with the offense, and it's 22 guys, you know, plus a few that come in and play bit roles, makes it harder for the quarterback to actually have that impact overall on the team because he's kind of isolated with the offense? And maybe that is a significant difference where a guy like Jordan is with everybody, right? He's as demanding on offense as he is on defense.
I think that might have been true, like when Bob Greasy was throwing 7 passes en route to a Super Bowl championship. But I think today where the quarterback and the passing game are such a pivotal part of it, and if it's not, and you're the Ravens, then you're a quarterback that's running for 1,200 yards like Lamar Jackson did last year. Like, nobody just hands off and doesn't run themselves. You're either a running quarterback that's a dual threat and you do things that everybody has to go, wow, he's the only guy in this locker room that can do that. Or you're the guy that spins it and, again, wow, he's the only guy in this locker room that can do it. I think Mahomes and you know, the Chiefs played a fine defensive game in holding the Niners to 20 points. Good. They held the Niners well below their average. So they played a very good game. But at the end of the day, the guy that really saved the bacon was Mahomes, caught fire and took off at the end. And I think everybody knew it. And so I think almost – he almost, because he can't go out there and carry you on the defensive side of the ball, he almost, that almost wills the defense to being better because they know, listen, we have to do our part because he owns it on the other side, so we can't let this down. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, and I wonder how that manifests itself in practice. Is it more of an example, or will he go out there and yell at, you know, defender or whatever, because he's, you know, he's slacking off in some drill? Because that to me is what, like, I envision Jordan doing, right? You're doing some monotonous drill that 30 or 29 teams don't take seriously, and Jordan takes this to, you know, like this is game seven of the finals and he's busting Steve Kerr's butt because he's not, you know, running 100%. Is that something that, you know, a guy like a Patrick Mahomes would be able to do? And if so, I think that has a huge impact because in football, it is probably way harder to get everyone on the same page. And if you have a guy at that position, which is the only position probably that can do that on both sides of the football, that would be a huge plus. That would be a huge win for a team.
We're talking right now to George Sharuri, Pro Football Focus data scientist. Switch gears here a little bit. Is Steve Spagnuolo maybe the most underrated guy in this Chiefs scenario than in the Chiefs organization and what they've built right now? Is he the guy who's the most underrated?
That's an interesting way to put it. He might be the most pivotal defensive coach in terms of what happens in the playoffs because of how good the Chiefs offense is, right? And the offensive coordinators get a lot of the shine for, hey, like you've got this cool system and it gets guys open and it's new and whatever. But on the defensive side of the ball, the defensive coordinator is way more of a 12th man than I think the offensive coordinator is because you can, on defense, it's less about any one singular player. You know, on offense, it's so much about the quarterback. But on defense, it's more about the units, right? How cohesive are they? How well does your coverage unit kind of play together, right? Because if you have one weak link, you're going to get exposed, right? And a lot of that is just the role and the coverage scheme that you put together. And we saw that, right? Before Spagnuolo, it was, hey, these guys are not that great, but we're going to put them out there on an island and they're going to win. Spagnuolo shows up and it's like, no, these pieces are going to work together, right? We're going to put you guys in a position where none of you are out on an island. We're going to support you with a pass rush. We're going to support you on the back end with coverage. We're going to blitz our linebackers a ton as they did in the Super Bowl, right? And try and bring everyone up to that level of average. And if you can get there, it's not an easy thing to do. You can win a Super Bowl. That's what you saw last year. So I like the idea of making him, you know, that underrated guy. And I think just overall it shines a light on how underrated defensive coordinators are. Defense is a super tough thing in the NFL. It's not something that's easy to repeat season to season. But if you have a guy like a Bill Belichick, who's at the top of his game, obviously, that can adjust and can create schemes that elevate all of his players, that's a super valuable asset.
Yeah, I think, you know, I know you had a tweet out there about what team was in their base defense the most, and it was the Seahawks, and they were pretty disappointing. I mean, he truly went Bill Belichick. And I can't tell you, you know, I know what he did in the Super Bowl with the, and I know about the NASCAR package and all that, but when you get a chance to cover a guy game in, game out, you see what he does and how different and how he was really, you know, opponent specific on the game plan and how once it all came together, it really took off. I don't understand why Steve Spagnuolo's name hasn't been talked about. I hope it doesn't, by the way, and maybe it's because I think he's 60 or 61. He's older than he looks. But he should be talked about as a head coach. I know it didn't work with the Rams, but as we know, that Rams situation was a mess on what was going on there. And well, I think Spagnuolo would make, given a second chance in a good environment, it'd be a great head coach.
Well, this is another philosophical question that Eric and I talk about a decent amount, which is that, and I think maybe you and I have as well, the difference between being a coordinator and a head coach. It's massive. And, you know, I think there's reticence in the league to hire guys where they're a defensive guru. And yet when you become a head coach, the most important thing that you do is manage everything and have a relationship with your quarterback, right? Because that's the prized possession. And so I'm not sure that it isn't a smart move to say, look, if I'm going to invest in a guy whose most important relationship is with the quarterback, it should be an offensive guy. But also to look at the drastic difference between you're in the trenches calling plays and being schemed, that's all you're caring about, versus you become the head coach and now you've got all these macro decisions. You're building culture. You're setting schedules, right? You're managing your other coaches. And that is a drastically different skill set. It just is. And always having to say, I'm bringing a guy from within who is, you know, great at scheme and he's all of a sudden going to become great at management and game management too, nonetheless, By the way, a lot of those decisions and game management happen on the offensive side of the ball. So I think thinking offensively is a smart way to go about it. I'm not sure that the lack of defensive guys becoming head coaches isn't just a smart move overall for the league, because it's an offensive league right now. I know some people hate to hear that, but that's just the fact of the matter.
Yeah, I think, like, how much, you know, they talked a lot with Spagnuolo. He mentioned, and it's been mentioned, you know, they took off at week 7. They got healthy around week 10, but it all started clicking at week 7. You know, if Chris Jones plays, which is a big if Chris Jones plays, should we expect that this Chiefs team should be even more dominant, because defensively they should be like those last 6 games and the 3 postseason games all year?
Yeah, so that second half of the season, that run, there was a little bit of weakness of opponent that I think should be characterized. And okay. And here's the thing. The consistency of a defense is, and the way that it stays healthy and comes together, that is something that just needs to be accepted is not going to be the case all the time. And so, yeah, if you're healthy, you expect a good defense, but you should never expect that health to be consistent. I think the Niners are a good example of that. They kind of got themselves back together at the right point, but they dealt with a ton of injury, you know, in that middle part of the season, faced some better offenses, and the defense looked very mortal. So, yeah, you expect, if everyone's together, for them to be a pretty good unit, but you're never expecting them to hit that peak for a long period of time. You kind of always say, look, little nicks are going to happen, and we need to be able to overcome those. And that's why I never get too worked up about great defensive performances. Yeah, they're fun, but you should never expect them to happen over and over again, because so many things have to go right. You got to face an offense that's going to give you opportunities. But certainly if Chris Jones comes back, I mean, if he's playing in a Chiefs uniform, I'll be shocked. But if he is, that is a super valuable player to have on the defensive side of the ball. There's, you know, taking pay out of it, he is a great guy to have on your defense.
Yeah, no, no.
I can't believe we're talking about that, though. I really can't.
Why?
I just figured he would have been traded. I was shocked that we got out of the draft and he was still a Chief.
Yeah, listen, and that's a riddle that I think we're all trying to figure out. The best one I can come up with, you know, there was somebody looking for a defensive lineman. I think everybody had to know that Chris Jones could be on the block. The Colts gave up a first-round pick for DeForest Buckner. So you look and say, well, why didn't the Colts call? I don't know. Maybe there's something that they don't like. I mean, the general manager was in Kansas City with Chris Jones. Maybe he's not sold on Chris Jones. He wanted a stouter run defender. He wasn't going to potentially make the team he's chasing better, right? He wasn't going to take the cap load off the Chiefs. I think everybody, they know each other's cap. They looked at it and said, well, why would I free up their cap and give them assets, high draft picks, number 13, to go get better? I'll play with the 49ers because if I see them, it's in the Super Bowl, right?
Right.
And so maybe that's it. But I do think the cap, you know, people start, because I never think I'm the first guy to it. I'm not the dumbest guy on the block, but I'm smart enough to know I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer. And so, but I think we did arrive here in the program pretty quick that, like, listen, the cap is not definitely going up. Stop saying the cap's going up when we're shutting sports down. Like, the cap is tied to revenue. And I think teams, if we figured that out, they probably figured it out earlier. And I think nobody wants to put 120, 30, 40, whatever he's going to get, million-dollar defensive lineman on the field. We know that that's questionable to begin with. I think the only reason the Chiefs did it with Frank Clark was they said, listen, this is our last best chance. Okay, I personally think if Chris Jones had taken their offer last year, Frank Clark wouldn't be here. When he didn't, they had the room, and they said, okay, let's go make this happen, and we'll get at least one, and maybe we put a franchise tag on Chris Jones. We get 2 years with them together, and we're at the closing moments of the Patrick Mahomes cheap window. And so it's been 50 years. So we're balls to the wall. Let's go all in. I think when it's been 50 years since you won a championship, your mindset is different than once you've got it. All right, now it's in the bank, and now you start trying to win as many as you can. And so you don't go all in for one, and you try to shift gears. Problem is, nobody else. So you're like, who's that team that's all in for one? And the answer ended up being none of them because they're terrified of the cap.
Yeah, because it was really the Colts, right? Like, the Colts were the only team that acted. And I guess, you know, the Saints are a team that does that kind of routinely year in and year out. But they, you know, they have some defensive linemen, and I don't think it would have made sense for them. I mean, they would have had to do gymnastics, right, to make that happen. But the Colts were the team that acted in that way. The Bucs to a certain degree, but the Bucs are interesting because the Bucs have invested in young players everywhere else. Like, they're a very young team aside from the two, you know, the two veterans that have come over from New England. So there aren't that many teams that are acting that way. And that should be a good thing for the league, that you don't feel like you can just unload these guys on some team that has no idea what they're doing. And it speaks to what we've been talking a lot about at PFF, which is your quarterback spending is important. Yeah, you want to have a cheap quarterback, sure. But quarterbacks are so much more valuable that if you want to look at it in totality, the Seahawks have made a smart decision by paying Russell Wilson a ton of money. The way they make that a poor decision is by then going and spending way too much on another position that isn't going to be that valuable. So the way that you maintain with an expensive quarterback, it's not that you can't, it's that you just have to be smart around it. And there are probably a lot of teams out there that are thinking along those lines, and that's why they're less likely to go say, okay, I've got this great quarterback, now I'm going to go bring in the missing piece, which is a defensive lineman, and pay him a ton of money. That just doesn't seem to be the case.
All right, we're talking to George Schururi from Pro Football Focus, data scientist. Time for our final four, brought to you by the Kansas City Orthopedic Institute. Four quickies. I'll start you with this. Is Steve Spagnuolo a head coach again, yes or no?
No.
Okay,
all
that's
offense.
Great.
I think the value is very much there to pay a guy on the defensive side of the ball, but the move to head coach, I think, is offense only.
Okay. That's great news for us as Chiefs fans. Rams new uniforms, yay or nay?
Ooh, man. I actually like them, except for the ones with the gradient numbers. I think overall they're fun, they're cool, they're new. So, yay. I'm going to be positive today.
They're crap. Like, you have perfection right there in front of you.
This is true.
I mean,
this is true.
So frustrating.
Everyone hates new things, though. Everyone hates new things. So I don't want to be the person that just jumps on the, look, it's new, and so I hate it. There are some parts, there are some versions that aren't terrible, that are closer to those old perfect things. They're trying to recreate them a little bit. Just no gradient numbers. Those are weird.
Yeah, no, I agree. All right, over or under 950 yards from scrimmage for Clyde Edwards-Helaire. That's the number I saw on one of the offshores.
Ooh, okay. Yards from scrimmage here. Man, I'm going to say over. I think he's dramatically better than any other running back they have, and he'll catch a ton of passes.
Okay, interesting. And finally, the last dance is now over. By now, you had to have watched every Bulls game you could drag out on tape. Are you binge-watching a show yet?
You know, I that's so funny. This weekend, I tried to start something new, and I tried to get my girlfriend to, like, suggest something. And so we started watching something that was like Queen Catherine or something or other on Hulu, and made it like a third of the way through an episode and was like, no, this is not great. I'm going to go back to watching the flu game. So I haven't started anything yet. It's bad. And honestly, the thing that I'm closest to now rewatching are NFL games. So we're not moving in the right direction here, unfortunately.
No, we've missed our window. We've missed our window now. All right, George. Always great catching up with you, buddy. We really appreciate it. Thanks for the time. Stay healthy, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Hey, likewise, brother. Anytime.
All right, George Schururi from Pro Football Focus, data scientist, does a great, great job. He's brought to you by our friends at Worth Harley-Davidson North. I-29 and Tiffany Springs right now. You can take advantage of no payments until November. Come on, brand new, beautiful Harley-Davidson motorcycle. They'll even deliver it to you. Don't know that they'll get it cleared to George and Cincinnati. In fact, I think they probably won't. But they'll deliver it here locally. It's Worth Harley Davidson North. Find them online at WorthHarleyDavidson.com.
The program with Soren Petro.
If you disappear forever, it wouldn't make any difference.
Weekdays from 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
All right, the Jazz, end of the hour answer. Horace Grant, one of three Clemson Tigers to score 10,000 NBA points. I asked for either of the other two.
Horace Grant, one of three Clemson Tigers, mm-hmm. over 10,000?
He is second of the three at 12,996.
Just 10K?
Mm-hmm.
Was Larry Nance a Clemson Tiger?
Yep, Larry Nance is number one, 15,687.
I don't think Eldon Campbell probably got there, did he?
Eldon Campbell was the third, barely, 10,805. Yeah. Good job.
I was thinking he was going to be right around that.
No,
yeah, they've produced big men.
For the most part, and four and five are Dale Davis and Harvey Grant. So
yeah,
so all big fellas. Tree Rollins is six. You know, you keep.
Wait a minute. Harvey Grant didn't play there.
They show Harvey Grant for some reason. Clemson is 700.
Well, did he start it at Clemson?
It could be. Let me see.
And then maybe transfer to OU.
Yeah, they show him Clemson and Oklahoma. So maybe that's why he's only fifth.
So they're giving him credit for both schools. I guess they're counting him towards both schools. But somehow they're in Clemson, South Carolina. They got a lot of 6'11 guys.
Can I just take a moment to celebrate the fact that we just mentioned Tree Rollins on the program? What a great day this has become.
Yeah. You're happy.
By the way, Tree Rollins was
player coach on one of the title teams.
He was player coach on what title team?
For one of the Bulls title teams.
No.
I don't see him having played for the Bulls.
He definitely played for the Bulls.
No. Okay. He may have coached for the Bulls. He did not play for the Bulls. Are you high?
Irrelevant.
No, but thinking about it, Larry Nance, 6'11". Eldon mm-hmm. Campbell, 6'11". Dale Davis, 6'11". Tree Rollins, probably 6'11".
Rollins, 7'1". But you knew a guy named Tree wasn't 5'8".
They're all big. Every one of the guys that out of Clemson that did anything are all big men.
It's something.
Maybe recruit a guard every now and then. And you might go somewhere. Maybe you wouldn't have lost to Carolina for 70 straight years. You know, sign a guard.
You know, it may be. And Eldon Campbell did not do anything to prevent Tate George's shot thrown by Scott Burrell. Now we've come full circle. By the way, that as much as the Leitner shot gets replayed. And it should because of who was involved and, you know, the fact that it was an Elite Eight game. Go back and look, and it's out there. The YouTube of that game, that Clemson-UConn game in 1990, that's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. The throw by Scott Burrell with someone in his face throws a perfect strike.
Well, and the someone is 6'11" tall, Eldon Campbell.
Yeah, throws the perfect pass, George catches it, lands, spins, and swishes one from 20. That's insane. The likelihood of that play is one-fifth of the Leitner play. Because Leitner caught the ball, dribbled, took a step to the left, and went to the right with it, whatever, and spun a shot. The Tate George play was insane. And it all starts with as good of full court length pass as you're ever going to see from Burrell.
Yeah. No, I'll buy that. I'll buy that. Great.
Not an avenue I thought I'd go down this segment, but.
But there we find ourselves.
There we are.
JazzKitchen.com, Jazz a Louisiana Kitchen. Go to JazzKitchen.com. Check out the great menu, and you can get it tonight on your way home. Grab yourself some great Cajun food from Jazz in Independence by the KU Med Center, 39th State Line, and out at the Legends. Jazz, a Louisiana Kitchen. Our thanks to George Shiruri there in the program. I'll hear from Steve Spagnuolo in a second. But, you know, I do think Spags is the most underrated part of that championship, don't you?
Yes, because he had some players, but to start where they were, to come in, take over that defense, and kind of start with the injuries and just horrible play that early on, to turn that team around by the halfway point of the season and have them playing your scheme, not just a different scheme, but a different scheme with different alignments, to go from 3-4 to 4-3, and it was kind of double. It'd be one thing to change, change a defensive coordinator and stay in the same alignment, but they did double that. And to have them playing as well as they were by the second half of the season is just remarkable.
In a passing era where he had a group of corners that the franchise had invested about $8 total yeah. in, and to go out there and become as good as they were coming down the stretch, I hear George, and I don't argue his point about, like, hey, what the teams they came up against in the coming down the stretch in the last six, that there was some softness of schedule. Fine, I'm fine with that, but. You know, they didn't give up much to the Texans offense because, muff punt, block punt,
yeah.
Those were point-blank things. You can take 14 off of the, off the books right there. That to me it wasn't a bad performance at all for them against the Texans. Against the Titans, what'd they hold the Titans to?
17.
17 points. And then they held the 49ers to 20. That was all good competition, and they did the job.
I take that back. Titans did score one late, but they had 7 points in the last 35 minutes of the game or 40 minutes of the game,
which is when if you're going to give up your points, don't you want to give them up early so your offense knows what they're going against? It's clear that they got us early, but it shows that Spagnuolo can make the adjustments. Yeah. And then they choke them out.
And you talk about, it's said in basketball, when people are, the other team has a run going. I mean, we need a bucket. We need to stop. No, you need to score some points. And during both those, part of the reason that those runs happened was because Patrick Mahomes and the offense was amazing, but it was also because defense didn't give up anything. It's hard to go on a 41-0 run if your defense doesn't throw a shutout.
Yeah, no, you can't come back. Yeah, I mean, you can't pile that up without the defense doing its part and handing the ball right back to the offense. All right, we'll hear a little bit of Steve Spagnuolo next here on the program.
The program with Soren Petro.
If you don't like me, just say it.
I don't like you.
Weekdays from 2 to 6 on Sports Radio 810 WHB.
Sometimes I feel so tired.
We ramble on here on the program. Sports Radio, 810 WHB. Hear from Steve Spagnuolo coming up in our next hour. We'll give you the things you need to know, including Jim Harbaugh's comments. It's funny how the attitudes around college football have changed. I don't know that Harbaugh's has, but they certainly have around college football. That's one of the things we'll hear. Also hear from Peter Vermees, where they are as far as training goes with Sporting Kansas City, and Seth Kizer coming up next hour. Let's hear Steve Spagnuolo talking about the defense. Let's start with what William Gay Jr. Will add to this defense.
Well, it's interesting. I'm different some ways with rookies, but I don't know that you know what you have until you get them here. And I look at Brett Veach and his staff did a terrific job identifying him. We're glad we have him. We're excited for what we think he can do. But until we get him out there, we won't really know. I mean, things jump off the chart with regards to speed. And he's a violent hitter, which we love. Hopefully all those things will transfer to this league.
He's a violent hitter, which we love. I love that line.
Yep.
And said in such a matter-of-fact tone.
He's a violent hitter, which we love.
He's a violent hitter, which we love. Yep. I think that's great.
No one's ever questioned the athleticism or that part of his game. So,
And the Chiefs need that. I mean, they talked about. Remember, a couple years ago, we talked about the being tough, a tough defense. Mm-hmm. He's going to make them tough. He looks like a Baltimore Raven linebacker to me. Spagnuolo asked if he has ideas on where Willie Gay will play and how long it might be before L'Jarius Sneed can be a regular contributor.
I think we'll probably begin with Willie at one of the outside positions. We think, without knowing right away, that we're hopeful that he would replace what Reggie Ragland did for us last year. Now, again, I preface that, Pete, by saying we won't know that until we get him. I think we're a long way away from, you guys get it. I mean, they come from college into the pros. And trying to get him up to speed takes a little while. And look at he loses, all these guys, all these young guys lose out on not having these foundation of reps, whether it's mental or walkthroughs. It feels like, guys and gals, it feels like 2011 when we had the lockout when I was in St. Louis and we didn't have all those guys. Now we're way ahead of that because we have these Zoom meetings. But I think Willie Gay will begin there. Whatever else we can do with them, we'll build on that. Jerry Sneed, I was very impressed with his tape with regards to all the things that he did. He played corner, and he's a big corner. He played some nickel and covered slot receivers, and they actually played him at safety. And I thought he did really good at all of them. We see him as a corner right now, and we'll see where that progresses to. But I think anybody that can come in with that kind of flexibility is a good thing.
I think that flexibility is, you know, exactly what he wants, right? We saw what he did with Fuller. You know, turning Fuller into a productive safety when they needed when Thornhill went down. So yeah, I think you want that flexibility in that D backfield. It's almost becoming the way Andy Reid looks at linemen, right? He likes versatile offensive linemen. Well, that's why your DBs need to be.
Yeah, because at some point you're going to be down a guy. So I mean, the idea you're going to play 16 games and then postseason and not lose someone who's key is, you know, it's a dubious thing. So to have a guy you can move around and put in a lot of spaces.
The catchphrase in basketball is positionless basketball, right? And while there's positionless football, I think there's definitely a positionless D backfield. You need so many of those guys out there to really be able to disguise your coverages and do different things. You need them to be able to play safety, play corner, be able to play some press, but also play some zone. And you know, I think they got some guys that they can do that with. They definitely got a couple of big corners in Keys and Sneed in this draft. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. Need to Know is next. Seth Kizer right around the corner. You're in the program. Sports Radio 810 WHB.
Time for our Deli Fresh end of the hour question. Sponsored by Good Sense. Chosen by KC sandwich lovers for 30 years. Good Sense. Not because it's easy, but because it's better.
All right, on this date in 1984, Roger Clemens logged his first major league win. Who hit the most career home runs off Clemens? Brought to you by Good Sense.